I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. In Scott Spencer's latest book, Man in the Woods, easygoing carpenter Paul Phillips steps in to keep a stranger from abusing his dog. The violence escalates, and Paul ultimately finds himself in a thorny moral dilemma when he harms a stranger more gravely than he had intended. Scott Spencer has twice been nominated for a National Book Award, and Man in the Woods is his 10th novel. It's published by Echo, and I'm very pleased that it brings Scott to our show. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Andy. How you doing?
I'm good. 10 novels.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of novels. Now, I have to ask you, does it get easier, or does each novel create its own problems and challenges?
Well, I think it's the latter, unfortunately.
Oh, that's,
I mean,
that's
you have
a bummer.
To. You know, first of all, your characters have never heard of you, so they just they're not impressed that you've written 9 books before you got to them.
So now, here in this book, you're actually revisiting characters from your book A Ship Made of Paper. You have some characters who are returning. Who are those characters, and what was your reason for looking in on them again?
Well, the characters that I revisit from Ship Made of Paper are Kate Ellis and her daughter Ruby, and I missed Kate because she had a lot of the best lines from Ship Made of Paper. And I was curious what had become of her. And when I started thinking about the story for Man in the Woods and knew it was going to be about a man who'd committed an act of violence and committed a crime, I thought it would be very interesting to have as a counterpoint to what he was going through to have a character who had a very, very religious view of the world. And when I thought about Kate, who was drinking heavily in Ship Made of Paper, I thought by now she'd probably be sober, and somewhere in those rooms she would have found God. And because she was funny and articulate and made her living as a writer, I thought she could spin that into a nice second career as a spiritual writer. And, you know, in fact, she wrote Praise Well with Others and is making a whole bunch of money. So, but besides the irony of that, it gave the book a chance to fall into a conversation that interested me about, you know, if there's no God, then everything's permitted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What were you, when you were sort of bringing her up to date for this book and turning her into this sort of inspirational figure, writer. Were you thinking of anyone in our culture? Was there anyone, because there are so many of those people who are doing that sort of thing. I'm just wondering if you were inspired by any in particular.
Well, I was thinking about a lot of them. You know, I had done a piece for the, I think it was for the New Yorker, about Christian filmmakers. So I spent a lot of time, you know, watching Christian TV and talking to Christian filmmakers and talking to Christian film distributors.
Was some of this the Left Behind films?
Exactly.
Those are huge. Not in New York.
Not so much in New York.
You don't see them in film forum. But that's Kirk Cameron, right? The star of the TV series.
There's all kinds
Growing
of
Pains
people and find work in those movies.
And they're sort of action movies about the Rapture and things like that.
Yes, they're about the Rapture and about war in Israel. There's a lot of action. There's a lot of explosions. There's a lot of screaming, and there's a lot of regret.
Sounds
especially
good
for those left behind.
Exactly. That would be me. So you were doing research into that world, and that gave you some.
Well,
some
that gave
fodder.
Me some, but it's really very unlikely that you're going to be spending any time in our culture and not be confronted with one way or another with the people who are putting forth a very profoundly Christian point of view. Mm-hmm. And that point of view has always been interesting to me as a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since novelists. You know, the cliche of novelists is half true, that we play God.
That is true. Now, before we move on, I have to ask you a question a little bit about your craft as a novelist, because I read this and I just want to hear it from the horse's mouth. That when you sit down to write a book and you write a draft and you go back and do your second draft, you kind of totally put aside the first draft and start from scratch all over again. Is that true, or is that an exaggeration?
Well, again, it's half true, like
half
so
true.
Many things are. I don't throw that first draft away. It's just that I don't edit inside of that draft. I'm not moving sentences around or mm-hmm. trying to, like, hone that draft. I will maintain the the method that I first learned when I was writing on a typewriter, which is to type another draft, because I think that you are just less conservative that way. You're writing the whole thing over. But I do have everything that I've done the first time there with me in a stack right next to my keyboard. So I'm not making it up all over again, but I'm just giving myself the freedom to change whatever needs to be changed. And also, I do feel that the movement of my fingers over the keyboard somehow lubricates my brain and allows me to write better than I do when my fingers aren't moving.
So if you just keep in motion, that can sort of create a kind of momentum.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. I don't understand why. I'm sure that somebody who knew something about brain chemistry could give me some reason why that works for me.
Well, it makes sense. And actually, I guess, you know, things from your first draft sort of organically fall out and you find that you don't need them because you're not looking at the draft and you're not trying to preserve your darlings or
exactly.
Whatever, then, you know, your brain may be doing some editing for you without, you know, actually going through and scrutinizing every line.
It does. And then there's sometimes when your fingers say, do I really have to retype that?
And you, that's, and if it's not worth typing, it's probably not worth reading.
That's a tell, as we say in poker.
It's a tell. Okay, so you've got Kate, who you've brought back. You know, she's like your Rambo. You've brought her back for the sequel here, and she's an inspirational writer and TV performer to some extent.
Ultimately,
and then you introduce this new character, Paul, who's sort of in opposition to her in a way. I guess you describe him as a man of action, a guy who works with his hands and
He's a man of action. He's more of a 19th century guy, maybe even an 18th century guy. I mean, his role model is Daniel Boone. I mean, he's the kind of guy who, if he's working on a piece of wood and he breaks his tool, he'll make another tool with what he has on hand. He's like a lot of people who I've come to know in my own life in upstate New York, these people who live off the grid. They don't need the creature comforts that we need. They don't need the security that we've come to depend upon. And they're just sort of they're islands unto themselves. And you can't help but admire them.
That's you live in Rhinebeck?
I do. Right?
Yeah,
I
that's
do.
Interesting. So you're in a way you're in sort of a version of this conflict, because here you are, you're a writer sort of like Kate, and you're up in your office up there, and you're surrounded by people who can fix things. Can you fix anything yourself? Can you repair anything around your house? I don't want to go to cliches or stereotypes about writers.
Jiggle the handle on the toilet if it's
you can make that work for you, but that's
I can do very, very minor repairs.
Rudimentary.
Very rudimentary.
Mm-hmm. So Paul is a 19th century man, and he is involved in this kind of epic, sort of epic battle in the woods. I don't want you to spoil the whole book, but can you sort of set up the basic incident, the instigating incident in this book that sets everything in motion?
Well, in the very beginning of the book, Paul's with Kate, and they're in New York, and she's doing a big event promoting her book. They have a blissful night in a hotel that her publisher is paying for. And then Paul goes to visit a couple of his high-end clients, because he makes a very good living, because he's awfully good at what he does, and all sorts of very, very wealthy people are bidding for his services. He has a frustrating day because things don't work out that well. He goes to see the apartment where he once found his father dead, and that doesn't work out in any satisfying way. And on his way back to upstate New York and to the town of Leyden, which is actually a town I've used about four or five times now in my novels, he stops at a state park just to basically the way you would maybe duck into a church to collect your thoughts. And he just, goes there to commune with nature, and he thinks he's alone and runs into a guy who we have already met in this book, who's there on a jog with a dog that he's stolen. And the guy starts violently abusing this dog for complicated reasons. And Paul steps in and commits an act of violence to prevent any more harm coming to this poor dog.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Scott Spencer, whose new novel is Man in the Woods. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So this is a big act of violence, as you described it. And the journey then Paul takes in the rest of the book is, would you describe it as a journey towards faith? He's trying to find some of the kind of faith that Kate has found in her life.
I think he ultimately does start to go in that direction, and you know, because of the perversity of couples, as he's finding faith, she seems to be losing hers. I don't think there's room on that little island of faith for them both to stand. I think that what's happening to Paul is that he is spinning around and around this idea, just as, frankly, I do, and I certainly did in writing the book. I mean, when I wrote this book, you know, at one point I thought to myself, this is really a very religious book I'm writing, much to my great surprise. And then further on in the book, I said, wow, this is a really anti-religious book I'm writing. And ultimately, I came to believe this is a, you know, very agnostic book I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that Paul is able to really solve the question of about whether we're alone. He's quite sure we're alone when the book begins, but then the idea that you can do things and no one will know about it and you will never have to take responsibility for it and you will never be punished for it becomes sort of morally and finally psychologically intolerable to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very classic, sort of a 19th century theme. I mean, isn't that crime and punishment? And
it is a little bit crime and punishment.
I didn't mean to.
No, I don't mind that.
I don't think
at all
that you had a draft of Crime and Punishment next to you or anything like that. I assume you had a draft of Man in the Woods.
I had a draft of Man in the Woods, but I did have a copy of Crime and Punishment.
Well, it's always good to have it around. It always can cheer you up. Now, you live with the writer, isn't
it? I do. I live with the writer Joanne Beard.
Right. And now you write some nonfiction, as you describe. You do some reporting, but she's primarily a nonfiction writer?
She has been, but she's coming out with a novel next spring.
So this is like the perversity of couples yet again.
Exactly.
You know, she's doing that. Now, is that helpful? I also my wife is a nonfiction writer, and I don't know what kind of a writer I am, but I guess I write. It's helpful being I actually find it helpful being in the same house as somebody who writes. We can help each other. Do you guys help each other working on disparate things? Is that helpful when you're writing a novel and she's writing a nonfiction piece, or vice versa? Or is it just too much anxiety and stress for one household?
Most of our anxiety and stress is whether the fox is going to kill our ducks when we're asleep.
Oh, you have a fox problem. You have a fox problem.
A little tiny fox problem.
Well, that trumps everything. In
certainly does. At first I thought, well, this is going to work out just fine because Joanne writes nonfiction and I write fiction, but it doesn't really matter. It's so helpful for me to be living with Joanne and also just to generalize, I think it's helpful to be living with a writer, mm-hmm. because writers understand the process that you're going through. They understand that you're working when it doesn't necessarily appear that you're working.
Right.
And they're just, you know, you have to be very sympathetic with what writers go through because you're going through it yourself. On a more practical level, I feel that I can really push myself to extremes of writing, knowing that that Joanne will read it at a certain point and take out the things that don't work. She's an amazing editor.
That's great. So that she's backstopping you in that sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, I also noticed this is sort of an interesting part of your portfolio of activities. You taught at the Bard Prison Initiative?
I did, just last year.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. What did that entail? And I assume they got a lot out of it. I would like to know what you got out of it.
I got a lot out of it. Of course I did. I think all the teachers who end up working there are amazed by how much they get out of it. It's an amazing program. It's a great program. Bard College has sort of stepped in where the state has dropped out and created college education for maximum security prisoners. And at the end of the process, they get an actual degree from Bard College, just like anyone else would who went to the college on campus. The coursework is very rigorous. They not only take writing, but they take German and they take philosophy. They take all sorts of, you know, anything that you would expect on a college campus. I found it to be really completely inspiring experience, not only to, you know, get to know the men and just sort of reaffirm that idea that you have that we're all basically the same, and they have that proved by working closely with the guys who are trying to learn how to write, but also to, because I would give them actual published work to read too, and ask them to write responses to it, and their responses to the work that I would give them, you know, be it Robert Stone or Alice Munro or Dennis Johnson or Rick Moody or Joyce Carol Oates, would be so profound and so interesting and so fresh and so full of, you know, inspiration, and you realize why we want to do this, that you have a chance of, if you write something, of reaching somebody who is so far away and maybe whose life experiences are so different from you, but you have that moment of communing with them that's really pretty magical.
Well, Stephen King calls it telepathy. You know, that it's mind-to-mind communication, which is kind of an amazing thing. Well, you don't really think about reading that way, but of course, that's
right.
Exactly what writing and reading is all about.
Right.
What I just have to ask you before we wrap up, what were some of the things that your students would write about?
Well, they would write a lot about their childhoods. They would write a lot about their mothers. Some of them wrote fantasy. Some of them would write about being confined in some sort of futuristic government facility. They would write a lot about imprisonment, but metaphorically. And they would write a lot about women and girls.
Sounds good. I want to thank you so much for being with us. I've been speaking with Scott Spencer. His latest novel, Man in the Woods, is published by Echo. Scott will be reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7, and he'll be introduced by Francine Prose. Good. He'll also be reading and signing books next Tuesday. Oh, at where? Where is that going to be?
Tomorrow is at McNally Jackson on Prince Street.
Okay, that's good. And then Tuesday at 7 at the Upper East Side Barnes & Noble, 86th Street and Lexington Avenue. Scott, thanks again.
It's a pleasure, Andy.